Hanukkah starts on Tuesday night, and for many Jewish families, especially those with children, part of that celebration is to munch on gelt, chocolate coins covered in gold and silver foil. Reporter Dina Pritchett unwraps the story of this sweet holiday tradition.
To be honest, Hanukkah gelt is not really known for being all that delicious.
It snaps. It's not soft and buttery. It's waxy. This is the chocolate that you have to chew.
Ariel Cohn runs Tree of Life, a Jewish preschool in Portland, Oregon.
Turn it.
The two-year-olds here don't seem to share the same criticisms of Hanukkah gelt.
Ooh, chocolate.
Yum.
Yum.
But even though the chocolate might not please adult palates, Cohn says she still has a soft spot for it, because it's Hanukkah.
It's what human life is made of. Holidays and gatherings where you see your family and your friends, and you can make anything a part of tradition, really.
But it turns out this particular part of tradition used to look a lot different.
In the old world, in Jewish Eastern Europe, and we'll call it the shtetl, we do find something that is called Hanukkah gelt, but it has nothing to do with children and nothing to do with chocolate.
Gina Glassman teaches Judaic studies at Binghamton University. She says that in the 19th century, Hanukkah gelt was basically an end-of-the-year tip for itinerant workers.
A butcher for kosher meat and a teacher for Jewish studies, and you'd even have a guy employed to bang on people's doors to wake them up for prayers. Hanukkah was a time you paid these men a little bit extra.
If people gave gifts at all, it was generally a few months later, for the holiday of Purim. But as families moved from the community-centered shtetl to towns and cities, that started to change.
By the end of the 19th century, you see mysteriously the custom switch from giving tips to these guys to giving a little gift to your children.
And when Jews began to emigrate, it changed even more.
As Christmas is magnified in the American setting, it becomes a national holiday. Hanukkah is greatly magnified.
Jonathan Sarna teaches American Jewish history at Brandeis University. He says that while Hanukkah takes on new importance, focusing on kids and gifts, it maintains echoes of the past.
We've morphed that gelt into chocolate coins as a kind of cultural memory.
Sarna acknowledges that the rise of chocolate gelt in the early to mid-20th century is a small part of Hanukkah. But adopting new traditions and connecting them to the past is part of the larger story of Americanization.
You were able to signal that wonderful sense of being part of the larger society and apart from it at one and the same time.
And just as with chocolate bunnies or chocolate Santas, a simple treat can be a passport to this history of belonging and ritual and nostalgia, no matter how the chocolate tastes. For NPR News, I'm Dina Pritchett.
This is NPR News.
If you've been yearning for a cup of mead ever since you read Beowulf in high school, and who hasn't really, this could be your moment. The honey wine is once again the bee's knees. Weekend Edition food commentator Bonnie Wolf explains.
Until recently, you had to go to the Renaissance Festival for mead fix. Medieval wenches serving the honeyed drink that's a little like wine and a little like beer. Now, the so-called nectar of the gods is the fastest-growing segment of America's alcoholic beverage industry. Not since the Middle Ages has so much mead been quaffed. Mead is the oldest known fermented beverage. Traces were found in King Midas's cave. Pliny the Elder gives a recipe involving rainwater, honey, and the rising of the dog star. Now, mead is back in a big way. Chris Weber is president of the two-year-old American Mead Makers Association. He says in 2000, there were 20 to 25 commercial mead makers. Today, there are nearly 250. And the largest growth has been in the last 5 years. Close to 40 new meaderies have opened just this year. Weber says California's 20-year-old Rabbit Foot, one of the biggest meaderies, has just doubled capacity to about 100,000 cases. On the other end of the spectrum, Charm City Meadworks in Baltimore is just a few months old and is already having trouble keeping up with demand. When they started in July, they were prepared to sell 200 cases a month. They now expect to sell more than 5 times that. Weber says the biggest complaint he hears from mead makers is they just can't make it fast enough. And interest only seems to be fermenting. The University of California, Davis, just held the country's first mead-making classes. Sold out. Mead is essentially water, honey, and yeast. But it's not all sweet. The new mead goes from bone dry to dessert sweet. And you can put anything in mead. Today's meads are flavored with chocolate, chipotle, horseradish, carrots, rosemary. Weber says he's sure someone somewhere is making mead with Brussels sprouts. The new meads are sold at liquor stores, upscale markets, trendy cocktail bars, and farm-to-table restaurants. As they say at Rabbit's Foot, mead, it's not just for Vikings anymore.
That was Bonnie Wolf. She is the managing editor of AmericanFoodRoots.com. Okay, take out your calendar, give it a look. There might be a pretty decent chance that between now and January 1st, you have some sort of holiday party to attend. Maybe you're even hosting one. Dan Pashman of WNYC's The Sporkful podcast joins us now with holiday cocktail party tips. Hey, Dan.
Hi, Rachel.
Okay, so what's the first thing we need to think about when we're going to a party this time of year?
Well, I mean, look, you're going to probably have a drink or three. And that's okay. It's a party. But look, of course, you don't want to be the person that everyone's talking about the next morning.
No.
So once the alcohol is in your bloodstream, there's no cure but time. But there is a period of time when the alcohol is in your stomach before it goes into your bloodstream where you can manage the situation with effective buzz management.
Mm-hmm.
And that is that I'll come in and have a half a drink or a drink on an empty stomach. And that will make me feel real good, real fast. Then you follow that up with some food, and food slows the absorption of alcohol into your bloodstream.
Good thinking.
And that way you sort of get a good, nice, pleasant buzz quickly, and then you want to hit a nice plateau phase.
Okay, so what about appetizers? Sometimes you go to a party, and the appetizers, that's where the action is. Do you have a strategy for appetizing?
Do I have a strategy, Rachel?
I know. Such a leading question.
I mean, my strategy is I think you got to use the buddy system, because I don't know about you, but I get overwhelmed. It's a lot of stimulation, a lot of options all over the place. So pair up with some help.
And then you send like a reconnaissance mission, then you come back and you're like, I saw the stuffed mushrooms. They're in the left corner.
You can report back, and you could also send one person to get drinks while you go get food or vice versa.
Okay, so we've talked about what to do if you are attending a holiday party. Very helpful tips. What about if you're hosting? Any advice there?
Yeah, well, first off, boxed wine. You know, some people say it's making a comeback. I say it's
what
been
people?
Here for... I'm saying it right now, and I say it's been here for years. It's getting better. It's getting higher quality. And also, it oxidizes at a slower rate than corked wine. And so if you buy some for Christmas, it'll still be good at New Year's.
Really?
So, yeah, there's a lot of practical reasons to go for boxed wine.
Okay.
But the main thing I have to share with you is that if you're throwing a party, the most important thing to think about is food pacing and blood flow. You don't want people consuming a lot of food and drink while being sedentary. Because the energy of your party will sag.
That is true. Yeah.
So let's say you're having a cocktail party at your house where there's no sit-down dinner.
Uh-huh.
First few guests arrive, they sit down on the couch. At a certain point, as more guests arrive, you'll have one more guest than you have seats.
Yes.
And it's kind of awkward, right? That one person is standing over the people on the couch.
Yeah.
It feels
I want to go get them a chair.
Right. You feel that urge.
Yes.
But you must fight that urge, Rachel.
Really?
Because you are at a crucial moment in your party that I identify in my book as the tippling point. This is the tippling point. And you have
to... Why couldn't you just say tipping? Why is it tippling?
Because to tipple means to drink.
Oh,
Oh, that's true. Okay.
And this is the moment at which you need to power through, because soon a few more guests will arrive, and the people who are sitting on the couch will be motivated to stand up.
Yes, which is what you want, because
you want
a good party. People are standing up, mingling.
That's right.
Oh, that takes discipline, though. Because what if the person's giving you the stink eye? Like, whoa, Rachel, can't you even get me a chair?
Well, as the host, you could go and stand next to that person and not sit down to make them feel a little less uncomfortable.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Dan, this has been very illuminating, as always.
My pleasure.
Dan Pashman is the host of the Cooking Channel web series, You're Eating It Wrong. His new book is called Eat More Better, How to Make Every Bite More Delicious. Thanks so much, Dan. Happy holidays.
You too, Rachel. Take care.
There's that catchy phrase, you are what you eat. Well, some nutrition experts say it's much more than that. What we eat can affect the world around us. A group of those experts, the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee, is meeting in Washington today. They're working on new guidelines for how to maintain a healthy diet. And for the first time, they are examining how our diet affects the environment. We are about to hear why lawmakers are telling those nutritionists to back off. Here's NPR's Dan Charles.
One of the first people in the nutrition community pushing for a marriage of nutrition and environmentalism was Kate Clancy. 30 years ago, she wrote an article aimed at her fellow nutritionists, saying when they give advice about food, they shouldn't just consider what makes people healthy. They should also think about food that makes for healthy soil and water.
Take a broader view of what they were advising people to do with regard to their diet. It wasn't just nutrients. It was foods and it was many other things, including the environment.
Earlier this year, Clancy finally got an invitation to make her case to that committee working on the dietary guidelines.
Good morning, everyone. Let me say that after 30 years of waiting, the fact that this committee is addressing sustainability issues brings me a lot of pleasure.
The fact that Clancy was there at all is a big shift in the world of dietary guidelines, because this group of academic experts has decided for the first time to consider what it calls sustainability, basically whether the planet can actually supply the kind of diet that the guidelines recommend. Members of this committee are not allowed to talk to the press about their work. But Timothy Searchinger, a researcher with Princeton University and the World Resources Institute, an environmental group, says this shift is important. Because producing food already claims half of all land where vegetation can grow. Farming is one of the biggest sources of greenhouse gases.
That doesn't mean farmers are bad. It means that eating has a big impact on the environment.
And the impact will grow along with the world's population. So if you would like to reduce your personal impact,
probably what you eat is more important than anything else.
You can have endless arguments about exactly which foods are worse than others, but researchers such as economist Thomas Hertel at Purdue University say a few big points are pretty clear. One is producing meat, especially beef, is especially costly. Beef cattle release methane, a powerful greenhouse gas. Also, growing the feed for animals takes a lot of land. Hertel says around the world, people are demanding more meat, and that's pushing farmers to clear forests and plow up grasslands.
That's been a major source of greenhouse gas emissions over the last couple of decades.
So if Americans who eat a lot of meat ate a little less, there would be a little less pressure on the world's remaining forests. This is what the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Panel has been talking about. Here's Miriam Nelson from Tufts University at a session a few months ago.
In general, a dietary pattern that is higher in plant-based foods and lower in animal-based foods is more health-promoting and is associated with lesser environmental impact.
The committee has run into criticism. The Meat Institute, which represents meat producers, says nutritionists don't have the expertise to take on environmental questions. But the most powerful opponents, it seems, are in Congress. They've attached a document called Congressional Directives to the massive spending bill that will keep the government running. And one of those directives expresses concern about this shift in the dietary guidelines, about considering environmental effects. It orders the Obama administration to include only nutritional information in those guidelines. This directive is not legally binding, but ignoring it would provoke yet another political fight. Dan Charles, NPR News.